Okay, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Chatting Between Takes. It's about a week and a half since we recorded our last one. Dad, how are things today?
Very good indeed. I had a lovely day listening to some music and writing some lyrics for another song.
Well, that sounds pretty lovely. By the way, to anyone listening, this is season two of my podcast, Chatting Between Takes, and I'm calling this one, this will be about a 10 or 15 episode thing we'll do called Conversations with My Father. And the reason I did this, and again, this is not a pitch, we talked about this last week, but he just wrote his memoir called Symmetry of the Tiger, Tiger with a Y. You can buy it on Amazon. And our chats about his life and life in general prompted me to think that maybe all of you listening might enjoy listening. By the way, Dad, I'm not sure if you know this, but last week we cracked the top 100 for comedy podcasts through the aggregator Podomatic.
Oh, lovely. That's nice to know.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing. When I first set up
I thought it was totally serious, not comedy.
This is actually what I was going to get at, is that when I set the podcast up years ago, I thought it would be funnier than it ended up being. So if you're listening to this thinking it's going to be funny, Dad, step it up a little today, will you?
Yep.
Crack some of those good jokes of yours. Talk to me about the music you're writing right now, because a couple people asked me about your writing, and I'm not sure if they know how much you are engaged with music.
I'm terribly engaged with music. Actually, it goes way back over 50 years to my first major affair, which was a grand opera, which would now cost, I would say, $10 million plus.
Grand indeed.
It was put on in the O'Keeffe Center, as it was known then. It was, what was it called?
The Hummingbird for a while?
It was known by the singers as the Hall That Beer Built.
Okay.
Not a great title.
That's a pretty good title.
Because it was a beer company that actually financed the building of it, along with some other grants, etc. And the opera was called Eloise and Abelard, and a composer called Charles Wilson and I began this opera, and we worked on it for about 3 years, we're spending an enormous amount of time, and yet we had nobody who was totally interested in it. We were writing it away up north, Podash Lake, and the only people who could hear anything about it were the loons that were looming around on the lake. And so,
were the loons the loons?
The loons were the loons. So who's going to put this on? And then, as happens in all fairy tales, Godmother came along, somebody by the name of Ruby. You know, we now know the Rubies. And she was the one who said, I think there's something in this. Gave it to the director of the Canadian Opera Company. He said, send the composer to me with this piano score. He played it, and he said, to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Canadian Opera Company, we're going to do Eloise and Abelard. Now, isn't that a wonderful fairy tale? And actually, it came true.
It's a pretty good fairy tale. Now, question for you, how'd it go? Did it work out?
Oh, it worked out very well. It played there along with Wagner and Verdi, if I remember. And then it went on to the National Arts Centre in Ottawa. And then the critic from the Times of London, he said that barring only two other Britain and one other music composer, he said this was the best he'd heard in years.
Well, that's lovely. By the way, this is the first time that... So when I went to theater school at George Brown, the head of acting, Peter Wilde, a couple weeks in, he goes, is your father Eugene Benson? And I said, yeah. He said, I saw Eloise and Abelard at its premiere. Lovely bell tones is what he said. So there you go.
That's good.
So by the way, we have a lot of questions because a lot of you listened last week. Thank you, by the way. You know, we do this for fun and we do it for free. And the idea that anybody is enjoying this while you're driving or cooking or just listening on your headphones or whatever is kind of awesome. By the way, I also heard back how much I sniffled last week. So we're going to try and do that less. So we've got some questions that we're going to get to relatively soon because I think they're actually wonderful springboards, Dad. People want to know things about you.
By the way, you asked me about music.
Yes.
The music goes way back beyond that one I'll tell you about, Eloise. Because I grew up in an Irish household, full of music.
Yep.
My father loved music, and we had fiddlers, dancing, all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And at parties, everybody had to contribute, whether it was singing or a rather unusual feature. giving recitations.
Okay.
And so that's the kind of thing that I was surrounded by. And so there was a great literature of all Irish folk music, and that was there all the time.
Now, let me ask you this, because I think a lot of times, especially with the proliferation of music since that time, I mean, this is the 30s, and you're not even probably getting a ton of radio, are you?
No, not very much.
What you're hearing is what you're getting.
Yeah.
Whereas now, every time you turn on your phone, there's music. Every time you turn on the TV, wherever you go, there's music.
Absolutely.
Do you think, I guess my question is, were you evaluating each other's singing?
And no.
Not
it
in the
was
slightest.
Purely spontaneous. It would be at a party, you would stand up, you would do what they called your party piece, and people would clap, even though you were terrible. It didn't matter.
So long as
you made your contribution, because it wasn't. How do you expect to find, a great singer in every household? But you expected everybody to join in and sing a song, recite a poem, do a dance. Why not? That was it. No evaluation.
I think it was grade 4 was the first time we had music at school, and the music teacher gave me N, which is the worst mark you could get on my singing. It was for needs improvement. That's what the N stood for. Yep. And she was an old school teacher who was like, if you're not pitch perfect, you're not good. And then it was a teacher a year later, maybe 2 years later, Mr. Young, who loved music. And if you loved music, you got an A.
Yeah.
And I love that. Yeah. I think that I've gone on to make money from singing, and I think that just doing it is its own reward.
The problem with evaluating music is that all the best musicians, whether it's in folk music, country or Western, classical music, is that the best of them break all the rules.
Right.
That's what happens. They break the rules, their chords. You say, what kind of a chord is that, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So the teachers don't know what to do with that kind of thing too often.
Oh, well, imagine Mick Jagger on a singing contest.
Oh, I know.
He wouldn't get past the first round.
Wouldn't get past it. Say, throw the guy out.
He's one of the best performers we've ever had.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to jump into something relatively deep out of the gate.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm curious about it.
Yep.
So last Friday, a week ago today, I celebrated 12 years sober.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody who's listening to this is probably listening because of my online and therefore know this because I've been posting a lot about it. So let's just dive in, Dad. What was it like for you being the father of an addict?
I didn't know about it most of the time because it's amazing how you can live under the same roof. You could live with people you love, whom you think you're closer to than anybody else, and yet one can create so many disguises. And so it was very, very late into your addiction that Mum and I discovered what was going on.
Right.
And we were shocked.
I was also in L.A. for the worst part of it.
Yeah, you were. You were away down in Los Angeles. We were shocked by it, disturbed, concerned. But we didn't panic because we felt that you were the kind of guy that would eventually face up to that, although we weren't absolutely sure because I'm no expert in this area, but they tell me something like 15% only can escape from the dreadful addiction that drugs or alcohol can create.
Yeah.
So you were very lucky. There was obviously a star, an angel, something looking over you. And in addition to that, of course, there was your own determination to get out of that and get on. So congratulations for getting out of
it for 12 years. But you know, what's interesting, Dad, is the first time I remember driving to see you and Mom after being sketched out on drugs for a couple of days in a row, it was only 6 years after that I got sober.
Yeah.
And, Roger, who's my brother's wife's father, he's the first person who said, you got to go to 12-step, blah, 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 all these kinds of things. But that was that early on. So there was a push-pull with that for 6 years until it actually happened.
Oh, yeah.
I remember you guys calling the cops a few times to find me.
We did call them a few times. We called them twice.
Yeah. Once in LA, once in Toronto,
because we had no idea where you were.
Yeah.
And normally you're pretty good at checking in. So
well, those were specific. You know, I would have said, stop bugging me, but it was when we were supposed to have met for things.
Yeah,
and I disappeared for 24 hours.
Right. No, it's very difficult for anyone who's got someone in the family on drugs or alcohol. I mean, what do you do? Because ultimately, they tell me, the experts, that unless the person has that deep, deep, deep desire to get out of it, to escape, to get away from it, to reassert the healthy part of their life, that nobody else can do it for them.
Well, and this runs in our family a bit, right? Oh, yeah. Well, some brothers.
I had a brother who was very alcoholic, and so I have others in there.
Yeah.
In any family, there is a skeleton, and the skeleton very often is connected to an addiction of some sort, usually alcohol or drugs. And even now, I hear children of my grandchildren tell me, and they're only 13, that in the school, vaping is going on among those kids. And that's, to me, that's dangerous, because until we know exactly what's causing the, sure. The plethora of deaths that yeah. are going on at the moment, we got to be very careful and, you know.
I yeah. purposely didn't buy a vape because of how enjoyable it is.
Yeah,
and apparently it's the chemicals they use to create the flavors that are the same chemicals that they used to use in popcorn factories.
Yep.
And it would cause scarring in the lungs to the people who work there. It's called popcorn lung. Yep. I'm not sure if that's specifically what's happening, but yep. I think it's just so.
Just another item to add to that addiction. You say in our family, yeah, I was an addict. And I was addicted to smoking.
Mm.
I was smoking.
Talk about this. I love this story.
I was smoking 2 packs a day. Can yeah. you imagine?
I can't imagine it, because I've never seen you smoke.
When I woke in the morning, I put a cigarette in my mouth. When I went to bed at nighttime, the last thing I did was butt out a cigarette. And I started smoking when I was 21. And I got hooked. I mean, yep. I was an addict. I loved my smoking after dinner to have a cigarette.
By the way, to those listening, I have a nicotine lozenge in my mouth right now. This is my 20-year battle with nicotine of some form or
and
another.
Then I loved having a cigar, a good cigar after dinner. Loved it. So all my associations were very, very pleasant. But I then became aware, so I started when I was about 22, when I was about, 1974, I realized that it was a cancer agent, despite what all the tobacco companies were saying. In their criminal behavior, they were poisoning
yeah.
millions of people throughout the world. And I was one of the ones. And so I thought, I got to get out of this.
Now, before we get there, you were poking holes in the sides of the cigarette, right? To make sure you would smoke but not get as much.
Exactly. I was using cigarette
holders.
It's
pure addict behavior. I forget about this with you.
Yeah, my friends who were concerned for me, such a heavy smoker, they got me a pipe. I was doing everything.
I think Orm still has the pipe.
Now, how did I get out of it? I had a student who was at the master's level, and he was supposed to hand in papers for me to mark, obviously. But he couldn't hand them in because something was holding him up. He was a brilliant student. I heard him giving oral presentations, but the written end product, he kept postponing. So finally I said to him, look, you obviously can't give it to me. There's something wrong. And it was the only student in my whole life. I recommended to psychological services. He went. Afterwards, I met him, and he told me that he now was selling houses, which involves a lot of paperwork, etc. And I said, "What happened?" He said, "I got hypnotized. They recommended me for hypnosis, and it took about 8 times visiting that medical doctor, in which my hand was clenched completely tight, and it was all about opening up my hand.
Wow.
You know, writer's cramp.
Yep.
You know, in your hand." And so it was done. I was so impressed by that that I got the name of the doctor in Guelph, phoned him up, and they said, nope, at the beginning, we only do heart attacks, very difficult subjects. And I said, I pleaded with them. They finally took me in, hypnotized me for 10 minutes. Out I went, never smoked a cigarette again.
Wow.
From 1974. Well,
I remember this because sometimes I'd smoke in the living room and you enjoyed it. You enjoyed the smell and cigars, but you couldn't put it near your lips.
I could not.
You can't physically put it near your lips.
It was like I could have blown up a bank. I could have committed adultery 50 times.
Have you?
No.
That we know of.
But I could not put a cigarette in my mouth.
Right on.
So that was quite wonderful.
So I actually want to get to a question before I get to some of the listeners' questions. Let's talk about authenticity. Now, growing up, you were already in your 50s by the time I was basically a sentient being.
Right.
And I feel, or in my experience, you presented a sort of, this is how a perfect life looks. And I feel that it was actually when my weaknesses started to show in my 20s with addiction that I started to get a more honest picture of your youth. I don't know if that makes sense to you, but I feel like I was shown to put your best foot forward only ever, but that it was actually through my vulnerability that I got a bit more of yours, such as I never knew you were addicted to anything because you've always had temperance. What about drinking? Where did that ever live for you?
Drinking for me was always a great pleasure, and I prided myself on, being a gentleman. There was that code that a gentleman did get drunk. Not to say that in my lifetime as a young man that I did get drunk. Of course I did. I worked, for instance, I lived for 2 years on an officer's military base in London, Ontario, with NATO. And there, you're surrounded by alcohol. And so sometimes I get drunk there. But always I tried to have that code, a gentleman doesn't get drunk. So that was what they
now,
prevented
am I wrong?
Me,
did you
think.
Once get pulled over and being drunk was the excuse for driving badly? Am I making this up?
Yeah, no, I was pulled over and then I had to explain why and I got fined for that.
Okay, you did.
That was just at that level where they were bringing in tests.
Right.
Before that, there was no problem. You could drive with anything and people did that. I mean, I can name some very important figures at parties at our house who drove off. And nowadays, after they brought in the tests, they would have been caught. And in my case, I was caught in that cusp, you know, of it. So they fined me. And after that, never again.
So the fine worked.
The fine worked.
The punitive measure worked for you.
Oh, yeah, the punitive measure. And so I said to myself, not again. And that never happened again. If I had to go to a party, I would make sure I had somebody to drive me back again, et cetera, et cetera.
So going back to the authenticity idea, I think you do learn. I've learned how to slow down driving by getting tickets for speeding. Going back to the authenticity thing, how important do you think it is? I obviously don't have kids that I know of, but a lot of the listeners do and are curious about your experience as a guy who had a family for 50 years, still does. How important is it to present the best version of yourself to your children or the realest version?
I think the best version. I think if someone is going to get drunk, for example, don't do it in front of your kids. Why offer them a bad example? If you are married, why would you have fights with your wife in front of your children? Best to keep that privately, etc. That doesn't mean to say you're being hypocritical. It means that you don't have to expose children to the more unpleasant sides of life.
Right.
Because most of the time, with one's wife, one's having a lovely time, etc. So why let the ugly moments out there in front of them, if you can, to protect them? They're going to meet with that kind of stuff later on, bullying at school, that can happen. Teachers who don't understand you. So my attitude has always been the sunny side. Try to create an ambience for your children of love, warmth, music, enjoyment, and downgrade the other.
Now, here's a fun question on that, because I remember at Orm's wedding, I was really emotional, cried a lot during his speech, and you suggested it might have been too emotional. Do you still feel that way? Now that you've become more emotional, we talked about this in the last podcast. And anyone catching up, my dad used to have a phrase called stoic imperturbability. And in the last number of years, just through, I don't know, perspective,
age,
mom passing and all that kind of stuff, I think you've really softened. And I'm curious if you still think that, I have no axe to grind, by the way, but if you still think that's the example of something where you'd want to rein it in more, or is that a good expression?
Well, I think one reins it in public. That if you're at a public function, then while you show grief, you also try to control it. And when you asked me the question, I think you said, was it okay? And I said, a little bit overboard. I was being authentic.
Right.
I was being honest.
Do you still think that would be overboard?
I still think it would be, but now I can understand it better.
Right.
And I've always been honest with you because I remember there was one play you did and you said, what do you think? And I said, oh my God, that was terrible.
Singapore? Singapore at the Factory Theatre.
It's still known as
one of the worst shows ever put on in Toronto. By the way, if you're an actor out there listening, I know I have a lot of actor friends. My dad always used to say, you're not a writer until you have a stack of rejection slips.
Yeah, right.
Because that means you're not submitting it, you're not putting it out there. And I actually don't think you're an actor until you've had a dreadful run of something that just didn't come off. Because the attempt at trying to make that work night after night, it really humbles you.
I remember that one. I think it was by John Palmer,
by John Palmer.
And that's a long time ago.
That was a long time ago. Yeah. I feel we all got hoodwinked by him suggesting that the draft he gave us wasn't the final draft. Yeah. And it was. Okay, pivoting to that, you get to evaluate me here, Dad. Phil Riccio, shout out to Phil Riccio.
Oh, yeah.
Phil Riccio has three questions for you. He wants to tap into Eugene's expertise. So, question one from Phil Riccio. What do you consider to be the greatest Canadian novel?
The greatest Canadian novel. That I would need to think about because I've got about a lot of things running through my mind. I'll take a check on that one. Really,
well, I don't think you need to take a check. let's talk about them. What's coming to your mind and why?
Okay. Well, I think if I look at it overall, I would say right away. I was putting it. I'll say The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah.
When I was teaching that when it came out, well, the 80s someplace. I remember saying to my student directly, they'll tell you about Orwell. They'll tell you about Animal Farm. They'll tell you about Huxley's famous Brave New World. I said, these are the best of the dystopias that are written out there. And I said to them directly, I said, this is a masterpiece.
Right.
I said, I think that in its genre, this is the best work that's been written in Canada. No signs of provincialism, no signs of amateurism. It's full-blown professional work of an international character, right. Absolutely.
No, okay, so I want to talk about this for a second. I want to get your remembrance of this event. So to the listeners, my dad and my mom were very good friends with Margaret Atwood. My dad still is. And
Graham Gibson.
And Graham Gibson, of course. So mom tells the story that she used to read people's pictograms. And what this are for the listeners is they'd have these parties. And my parents used to have these massive 60, 100-person parties. And I remember as a kid, and that was the tail end of your social life because it started to fade in the 80s. And I have remembrances of how joyous these parties were. But mom mentioned a smaller one. I think Robin Skelton was there. Yep. And she wouldn't know who drew a drawing.
Right.
And then she would decipher the person's personality.
Exactly.
And she pulled up one and said, this person has literally no imagination.
That's right.
Whose is this? And then Margaret Atwood put up her hand, and everyone sort of did the whole intellectual sort of as if. Yeah. And Margaret said, no, she's absolutely right.
Right.
I only write what I see.
Yep.
Did that happen? Is that true?
That happened. I still have the pictogram, by the way.
Yeah.
I still have it. Yeah. She loved doing that. And now, I was astonished at Margaret saying that because I think she's got marvelous imagination, but Renard may be right.
Well,
she may be that Margaret Atwood looks at society and her eye is, rather than the eye of an artist, it's the eye of an X-ray machine which picks.
Well, this is why I brought this up, Dad. Sorry to interrupt, but Handmaid's Tale has proven to be literally a 100% accurate description of what 2019 is trying to be for right-wingers.
It's quite remarkable.
They would love to legislate women's bodies to that effect, and they've even talked about, deciding people have to have kids, etc. Yeah.
There's no one has put the, how would I say, the literary stethoscope to the human frame more closely and more accurately than Atwood.
I mean, did you just coin that phrase right now?
Yeah. Right.
Literary stethoscope to the human frame. You heard it here first,
right,
people.
Yeah. Right. I think so, because when you look at that way back then, people thought, no, this is science fiction. Which she never uses that term, by the way. She doesn't like the term. She says, I don't write science fiction. But I do think that she is extraordinary the way that she has read the what was happening at that time. She was, how would I say, stimulated or upset by the Ayatollah Khomeini,
okay,
who came to Iran and introduced very powerfully all the repressive regimes,
sure,
theocratic regimes, of the Muslim world. But at the same time, the mirror image was the Deep South right-wing,
yep,
people, Christians, who are champion Christians. But, of course, the United States is supposed to be a non-Christian society.
Yeah.
I mean, there's supposed to be all the,
they forgot that
all
part
the fathers
lately
of the Constitution all said There's no religion here. You have that in your private home. Must not be public at all. But anyway.
Okay, so let's pretend it's Handmaid's Tale for now. Any others that had been roiling through your brain? The greatest Canadian novel of all time.
Let me see. Well, one that I found wonderful was Hugh MacLennan's Two Solitudes.
Okay.
It was a very early novel about, the Two Solitudes in Canada, the French and the English. And what was remarkable about his, and here I move a little bit from the literary side to the cultural side, the political side, was that he highlighted in a fascinating way the two solitudes, that we had a French society and an English society, and then focused on the inequities that mainly were happening with French society, the Quebec society, where it was quite extraordinary, the deprivation that the French-Canadian people were suffering.
Federally, you mean? As a result of federal, like the way Indigenous cultures are as, now, not obviously and, as
the result
bad.
Of colonialism,
okay.
That the English, the French were expected to speak English, but the English weren't expected to speak French. The ghettoization that was going on there, all the best jobs were going to, English rather than French-Canadian. And in a very small example, in the Houses of Parliament restaurant, the menu, for instance, up until I think about the 1970s, was one language only. Guess which language it was.
Yeah.
It wasn't Swahili.
Yes.
It was English only. That's it.
So what do you think about the current state of French English? Do you think that people living in British Columbia should know more French?
I would think so, but I think it's unrealistic. But the introduction by Trudeau, Pierre Trudeau, about whom I have lots of reservations, but anyway, the idea of introducing the equal value of both languages is a wonderful concept.
Yeah.
It's very good. You have it in Air Canada, all this sort of thing. And that is very, very good. But I don't think it will ever become that French will ever become the working language of people in Alberta or BC or Saskatchewan. Although in Alberta, which many people often think of as right-wing country, they actually send more people, kids, to French language schools than any other place in Canada.
Really?
I read some time ago. Huh. And I thought that's wonderful.
Well,
Why not?
That is wonderful.
Why not?
Okay, we're going to call those the two novels.
Yep.
The next question, there's three from Phil. The greatest Canadian play.
Greatest Canadian play. I'm going to say off the top of my head right away.
I think I know what you're going to say.
I'm going to say Jitters.
I thought you were going to say Jitters as well. I know you
did. Did you?
Your mum loved that show.
I think it's a wonderful comedy. When I stack it up to so many comedies, even internationally, it scores very, very high. There was one by Frayn, Noises Off,
okay,
which to me is the best show I've ever seen in terms of sheer comedy.
Okay,
but Jitters is not very far, and that's internationally.
Yep.
Noises Off is A++. Jitters comes closely behind it.
Right
I've
on.
Always loved that particular play. And now, if I were to go to other plays, again, I'll leave it at that.
And then the third question, and here's where you get to evaluate me. Phil wants to know what you consider Sean Benson's, that's me if you're listening, greatest performance of his career so far.
I'm going to, like a politician, I'm going to dodge at that question.
No.
By giving you two answers.
Oh, okay, well, that's
two,
fair.
One is in TV, the other's on stage. On the TV, one called Cold Case, and I thought was an extraordinarily good performance combining a combining wonderful identification with the character and a complete mastery of a Southern dialect.
Yeah, that one worked out very nicely.
I thought so. And the other one was one that should be better known. I don't know if it's ever been taped, was Liver.
Ah.
It was a show called Liver, which I thought your performance, and indeed the performance of that company, was it Kat who was involved
Kat
in?
Kat Sandler. So to
Kat
the people
Sandler.
Listening, Liver was a play I did about 4 years ago that Kat Sandler, who's my favorite Canadian playwright, wrote and directed, and it just worked. It was fabulous, and the cast was incredible.
I loved her work because it was wonderfully colloquial. You know, there was nothing highbrow about it. It wasn't concerned with events in the past. It was just so absolutely colloquial how she managed to achieve that voice. I found just absolutely wonderful. And your performance, I thought, you know, it was a very good, very good cast. But I hadn't seen you on the stage for a while, and then I realized...
First play I'd done in 14 years. That TV money got me excited, and it was hard to go back to theater.
Right. Well, anyway, on
true
stage,
story.
I thought that was a very, very powerful statement you made.
No, I appreciate
it. Yeah, that's that.
Okay, let's go with Jonathan Coleman.
Oh, Jonathan.
Hey, Jonathan, how's it going? So Jonathan Coleman grew up on the same park we all kind of lived around and was my brother's best friend, maybe still is. I'm not sure how they phrase that. Jonathan has a question for you. Is he still flying the NDP flag? Yes, I'll ask these in parts. Are you still flying the NDP flag?
Yes.
What do you think of the NDP party of today? Have they become too centrist?
No.
Okay, I'm going to read you the rest of the question, then you can comment. Or has the base changed? I live in a manufacturing town, and the best-paying jobs are blue-collar, which has seen voting change along the lines of support for labor to personal tax cuts. Where does the NDP fit moving forward?
Well, go back to that question. They haven't...
Basically, the blue-collar jobs used to be NDP and union supporters, but now they're more in favor of tax cuts, which would be a PC thing.
Right, they would go that way.
So where do you see the NDP fitting in that moving forward if they're losing their blue-collar base?
Well, they've always had a tough time because we always think NDP unions go together. When I ran for the NDP, as I did in 1967, I even found then that they split off towards the Liberals or even the Conservative.
Right.
Because there is a tremendous pull, I've found, in the working class and also with people coming in from... immigrants, to identify not with a newer party such as the NDP, but to establish the Canadian-ness by identifying with one of the two better known, more traditional, long-existing parties such as Conservative and Liberal.
Right.
Now, one could do a lot to fight against that, but it's a tough hole.
Sure.
And then the other thing is that very often, too, that the NDP is identified by, you know, labor, blue-collar workers and all that kind of thing, with trying to raise taxes. And it is difficult to understand that raising taxes is not necessarily a part of the genetic setup
right.
of the NDP.
It's not actually the platform.
No. But that any progressive party, I use the word progressive, if it's going to do the things it should be doing, has to raise taxes. There's no way around it. And you gave me away years ago, Sean, Gibbon's history of decline and fall of the Roman Empire. And continually in that, the battle is between the people and those who are ruling, raising of taxes. And there's no getting away from it.
Right.
If you want to seduce the people, fool the people, you say, I'm not going to raise taxes.
Yep.
The day after you win the election, you begin to say, where do we raise the taxes to your cabinet? And so that is why people, blue collar, are trying to say, let's be safe. We know the NDP will raise taxes, so we're not going to vote for them.
Right.
The other guys are saying they're not going to raise taxes. That's, I think, part
sure.
of the reason.
Sure, I get that. Okay, here's one from Sally Singing. Sally is an Instagram follower of mine. Hi, Sally, how's it going? Thank you for your question. Very simply, what has been your dad's proudest or greatest achievement? That's a nice question.
Well, I'll tell you, it's been... having a family, wife and two children. I've done a lot of things, travel, you know, publishing books, all that sort of thing. But ultimately, it's family. I mean, nothing can compete with that. Children, we read about, well, you have a child that's going to cost you $150,000, $200,000 raising it up at the age of 18 or through university. People do it. And why do they do it? Because blood and bone... blood calls, it's love. That's
right.
What it is.
Yeah. Now, aside from the fact that we get to do this and my brother lives a block away from my dad, and so he probably sees you more often, but for less long periods of time and for less interesting conversations,
right.
Obviously, he doesn't have the canon of knowledge I have. Or but in any case, does your pride ebb and flow? I don't want to go back to the addiction thing. We covered it, but do you lose pride during periods where your kids aren't doing as well? I don't have kids. I don't know what that looks like. I don't know what that love looks like.
No, pride. Pride has nothing to do with that.
Right.
If one's kids aren't doing well, I don't think that affects at all the mainspring, the tree trunk,
right.
The bases. It's irrational. It's blind. You love your kids. And that's it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, nothing more one can say, really, in that respect.
Katie Kirkpatrick.
Oh, I remember Katie.
My dear friend and once girlfriend. Yeah. Hi, Katie. How you doing? Katie's question is very simple. How did you put up with me?
Well, the thing is, Ormond was a very easy kid to put up with. When Ormond went to school, it was always the teacher saying, what a lovely boy, et cetera, et cetera. I had to, Mum and I would go along to the teachers because they would say, Sean, who was at this time 7 years of age, they'd say, he's disturbing to me, to the class. And I'd say, why? Because the teacher would say, in my teaching, I've got step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I get to step 3, and Sean would put up his hand and said, here's the answer. I said, that's very disturbing for a teacher. Now, Renata would get angry at that.
Yeah, Renata's my mum.
And mum. And she would say, but that shows he's a bright kid. And so it ended up, they would fight with each other. So after about 2 years, we agreed, Renata, my wife and I, that only I would go to school for fear that she would strike the teacher or the teacher would strike her.
Yep.
So I would go along and I would listen. And I think I understood what was going on. Sean was a very bright kid. He was also a kid who, without question, was arrogant in knowing that he was a very bright kid. So,
which I think we can just call arrogant.
The teacher and student clashed. The astonishing thing was that when he got to grade 13, guess who was the valedictorian? Sean. And by that time, the teacher all said, we love him. It's like Paul in the road to Damascus. He found salvation. Can you believe it?
Yeah, I did mellow out by the end of that. I'd say one of my greatest achievements, going back to Sally's question, is being a little less arrogant, hopefully. There you go, Katie. So that's how he did it, was through pride and by making sure my mom didn't go to student-teacher meetings.
Right.
John Rogers. John's a dear friend of mine from camp. Now, this one's a little bit more to me, but I'm going to read it anyways because it goes back to how we opened. What kind of role did your dad play in promoting your early musical foundational development? John says, when I met you at 16, I was inspired by your enormous catalog of chord progression, song repertoire, soloing ability, all while singing along. And then I saw you sit at the piano, blew his mind. Your drive to play stoked a fire in him that keeps him playing and singing and dancing today. John, that's amazing.
What a lovely question. And I'm going to have a sip of my coffee while Sean answers it. Yeah.
John, no, that really is a lovely question. And I mean this very sincerely. If anything I did means that you're singing and dancing more today, like I'm actually touched by that, because that's kind of what I hope to do in this world, is spread that kind of not just joy, but joy to do it oneself. And like we talked about with the singing, I'm sure you sing beautifully, but it doesn't matter. It's just to do it. And especially the dancing. If I think about it, Dad, the major role when I was younger with you was more your love of music and it being around. You know, my dad would sit at the piano and play for a little, not forever. And then there was always classical music playing in the house. I mean, the whole time I grew up, there was a classical album playing in that living room. I will say that Mom was more hands-on with, you know, the second I picked up the broken, beaten old guitar we had and could play a semi-chord, she'd bring me down to Gordon Taylor Music to, you know, find that guitar. And when I started to get out of piano, you know, she'd promote that. And you were both wonderful at listening to the music Ormond I would play in the living room and all that kind of thing. But the one thing you and Mom were so incredible about, and I think this goes back to what we talked about in the last podcast with even the beggars coming to the house, being paid for providing music, is that if I had any inkling toward an instrument, you'd provide lessons or the instrument itself.
Mm-hmm. That is true.
100% true.
Yep.
Yeah. And then, hold on, I'm just adjusting microphones, people. John, it's funny because my dad and I, before we started the podcast, he played me a piece of music. Dad, what's the piece of music
that we're playing now?
Yeah, the one we're going to write.
Oh, Schubert, and it's a number. It's called Nocturne.
Okay.
A Schubert Nocturne in F.
Yeah, so beautiful, it's a stunning piece. And then my dad and I have been talking a lot about Willie Nelson and country music and Johnny Cash and that kind of thing. And we're actually going to write a piece that he wrote the lyrics to, and then I'll adapt the Schubert Nocturne, and that'll be a starting point for a song we're working on together. Mm-hmm. And I actually recorded a little video, actually for my own archival purposes, but maybe I'll post that to Facebook, of us working through hints of the lyrics and what the song could sound like. So hold on, we've got one more question here for you, Dad. Oh, it's from Eric Shaholm. So Eric's one of my best friends since we were 12. We were just sailing together. Eric wants to know, you know, he knows that you traveled, I told him, to Mexico to write your first novel, and you traveled to Spain to write The Bull's Aranda. And he was asking about your relationship between travel and writing those books. Could you have written the Mexico book in Ireland? Could you have written it in your study in Guelph? Or Bull's Aranda? Did you need to take the trip? Talk about travel relating to writing.
Interesting question. Yep.
Eric travels a lot.
I did need to travel. For instance, my first novel was called The Bull's Aranda. And in that novel, the action moves around Spain, and then it moves to North Africa, to Morocco and various cities there, Marrakesh,
etc. By the way, this novel's wonderful. I'm just going to interrupt. Sorry, Dad. I read this very young, and it was on my parents' shelf, and the idea of seeing my parents' names on the spines of books was not foreign to me, which is kind of cool. And the one thing I love about it is it's just a proper adventure novel, you know? Yep. And I know that at some point it was considered by the James Bond Corporation
right.
to be incorporated into, because like you just went and wrote a full adventure book taking place in all these countries.
Yeah, actually it was an adventure book, but Graeme Gibson, the writer, he said it had a very profound moral character to it. Anyway, it was called The Bull's Aranda, and I was had gone to Spain with Renata, my wife, and we were there, and I went to see a bullfight, which was, it was a mess. Amateur bullfighters slaughtering the bulls that were inferior. It was just a mess. And I wrote I began to write a short story debunking the whole glamour that so often surrounds bullfighting.
Now, did you have any this is my Hemingway moment, or did you really care about that?
No, I didn't care about it, because I was going there to write, actually. I set out to write a play about the conscription crisis of 1944, the Mackenzie King government. But when I
that
was
would have
in
been fascinating,
yeah, when I was in the south of Costa del Sol in Spain, somehow Ottawa with the conscription crisis seemed a little remote to me.
Right.
And then when I went to this awful bullfight, I thought I'll write a short story to get me going. And then I read it to Renata. She says, "I think you're working on a novel," and I said, I thought to myself, I am. Anyway, the novel, as it was concerned with bullfighting, I sort of thought, what is it? Where did bullfighting start? And I discovered that it started in a place called Aranda. So I thought, I know nothing about Aranda, I'd better find out. So I packed Renata and my son, who was 2 years of age at the time, Ormond, into our car, and we drove to Aranda, way up in the mountains at that time. This goes back 50s, more than 50 years ago. And we visited the place where they created bullfighting.
Wow.
And then my hero in the novel, who was a young Canadian, I start following him around, and he's being pursued by the police, who are wondering what he's doing messing mm-hmm. around in Spain. And that takes me then to North Africa, Morocco, and there I meet up with further characters. Then that ties it in with the Basque movement that was looking for freedom at the time, like the Catalan movement is looking at the moment. And so I said to Renata, guess what? We're going to have to leave the Costa del Sol and head up to San Sebastian in the Basque country. And up there we
went.
And
her response was?
And her response was, oh, no, why do we have to go there? And I said, because I know nothing about the Basque country. It's in the novel, so I got to find out what it's like.
Yep.
So I remember at the last week that we were there, wading in a river while Renata sat in the rain in the car looking at me. And she said, what were you doing there when I came back? I said, I wanted to make sure that the final scene of the novel, which plays out here,
spoiler alert,
is in it takes place at this river, which runs just on the border of France and Spain. Mm-hmm. So that was my reason for doing that kind of thing.
You know, you could have Googled all of this.
Yeah. Right. I could. No, you don't get the feel of it. Now, the next novel I did was called Power Game. I'll make it short. Power Game is about Ottawa.
Wonderful novel as well, and I'm not just saying that.
Yeah, and it's about Ottawa, and it's a satire on Canadian politics. And there, because I knew Ottawa fairly well through my work at the Writers' Union of Canada, et cetera, I then thought, I think I could do it. And I had run in politics also. That helped. But I did a lot of research in establishing, you know, where one would go in Ottawa as a politician, what one would do. So it ended up as James Joyce. I'm not comparing myself to him.
Do it.
But
I'll compare you. You're better.
He wrote.
James who?
He wrote in Dublin. Hack. And he had, they say you could reconstruct a map of Dublin from reading closely Ulysses, his great novel. Well, I did the same thing with Ottawa. So when people would go out and look and say, oh, there's a statue of D'Arcy McGee, it was there in my novel in the exact place where it should be. So in other words, I've always felt in my writings that, yes, I would tie in what I was doing to the physical geography of the place to give it that kind of authenticity.
You know, I love that. I love it, too, because one of my favorite acting teachers, he once said, if you want to tell the story, you have to have taken the trip. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going to come back to the campfire and talk about the wolves on the other side of the mountains, no one's going to buy it if you didn't come back from the other side of the mountain. And it's funny because even with my addictions or my journey through life, and that's a big part of it with my LA and this and that, I'm not sure what I have to offer. But what I have to offer is because of the trip.
Yep.
The trip is why I get to have whatever moments I'm granted at the campfire in the light with people watching and going, what is your thought on this?
Absolutely.
And as you're describing that, it seems, and Eric, I'm going to put a bit of a bow on this, and my dad can after, but it seems inherent in the work that you go to the place.
Oh, yeah.
It's not even remotely possible to write that from elsewhere.
No.
If you haven't tasted it.
I agree. And the thing is, too, about acting, because I've discovered that actors, they get really good actors who are totally professional. They immerse themselves or try to deeply, deeply into the character and the whole, how would I say, physical, psychological, spiritual ambiance of the person they're playing in a way that the rest of us can't do very well. A writer may try it, etc. And so that's very important. And that is what I mean by sense of place,
which
place relates to all of those characteristics.
All of those characteristics. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We've got two more questions. And actually, the last one is going to wind us up beautifully.
Wonderful.
So before we get to the last one, which I'm going to wait on because it's a really lovely, deep question. Brendan, cousin Brenda.
Oh, cousin Brendan.
Brendan Monahan, one of my best friends and my cousin and one of my favorite people on the planet. Brendan just basically wants to know, who's your favorite writer? And separately, who's the writer that most influenced your thinking? That's a good question.
My favorite writer is not James Joyce, although that's what I did so much study of, but rather W.B. Yeats, the Irish poet, Nobel Prize winner, magnificent writer. And the wonderful thing about reading Yeats is that he's a very fine poet as a young man, but he realized all his life that he had to keep growing and growing. Mm-hmm. And in one of his poems, he talks about, you know, shedding all the, how would I say, the plumage of his youth and early middle age and withering into truth. And when you read the poems of his middle age, right, and his old age, absolutely stunning. Poems like Byzantium, Sailing to Byzantium, these are absolutely marvelous. And for me, all my life, I've read those poetry. So that would be my favorite writer. What was the other question?
Well, I'm just going to comment on that. Interestingly, so I recently have become a huge Bruce Springsteen fan, and I have no attachment to any era of his. I wasn't listening to his 70s music in the 70s. So his music is sort of sitting in front of me all as a pile with no emotional attachments. I mean, sure, he was popular in the 80s, but that's not what I'm getting at. His most recent album that he wrote and released at age 69, I consider as good as any of his works. It's arguable. People will argue with me on it. Some people have. Our friend Atticus doesn't agree. But I think his... And to me, I'm so astonished when it's one thing when a band has an 8-year run and it's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's another when an individual at 23 is writing a song I can put on and brings me to tears. And at 69 is writing a song I can put on and brings me to tears. I'm shocked at the depth of a person's ability to maintain that output over a lifetime. That sounds like what you're describing Yeats as having done.
Yeah, absolutely. You see, again, it was an interesting phenomenon that most of the, in science, Nobel Prize winners, those who get the greatest discoveries, it nearly always happens, if you could, one could check on this, to younger scientists, 20s and 30s, early 40s. Writers, very different. They mature over a long time, and the genius of the scientist, you know, blazes right away in their early years. Later on, the writers do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
They wither into truth if they're lucky.
Beautiful. Yep. So here's, I love this question, Brendan. What writer most influenced your thinking? And I like how we phrase that. It's not your writing. It's not the best writer, but who most influenced your thinking?
James Joyce.
Yeah?
Yep. James Joyce. Because James Joyce dealt with a lot of the question that I was dealing with in my own life, and many Irish do, the relationship of Ireland to England. He pondered that a great deal. The role of sex in one's life, because Ireland was a very puritanical country when I was growing up, both in the north of Ireland and the south of Ireland. And then questions about the nature of a writer. And I have a chapter in my memoir about the what it is to be a writer, that the vocation of the writer. And Joyce is always, well, not always, but so very often in his short stories, in Ulysses, even in Finnegan's Wake, wondering about the role of the writer, and in his time, because of his context, his nationality, asserting that the artist is the supreme agent in salvation, and he used that word, rather than the priest of a prescribed religion.
I buy it.
And those questions interested me very deeply. So in that sense, I would go with James Joyce.
And then how has your, how did you have to bloom sexually coming out of Ireland? How did you have to go, oh, there's a whole world, there's France out here.
You know,
how do you go from Ireland to France?
I know that was the thing. How do you go from celibacy? Because I had taken a vow of celibacy along with a vow of obedience and a vow of poverty.
So my dad, if you don't know and haven't read his book yet, Symmetry of the Tiger on Amazon, shout out. He had been going through the seminary. He was going to be a Catholic priest.
Yep, that's right. Well, again, I described that transition going from that life, and suddenly, you know, a month later, you're in a busy cosmopolitan city. You are surrounded by all of the, what would you call it, the material things of life, whereas the other one was you were giving those up under a strict Jesuit discipline, and now you're faced with that. How do you make your way in to that new life, which involves all the sensual, materialistic aspects of life, including money, which I talk about, including women, which I talk about, and how do you find a girl? I was 21 at the time.
So how 21. Did you?
How did I? My sisters helped me.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. And that, to find out how that worked, you have to read the memoir.
Right.
Otherwise, it would take me too long.
Right. But so basically, you just had to start, like all of us do, fresh at a certain point, but without having thought that you were going to engage those things.
Yep. And none of the normal stuff that you would do at, you know, 17, 18, 19, where you are running about with girls who are putting their arms around you, or you're putting your arms around them, you're falling in love, all that, being introduced to sex. That had not been in my life.
Right.
So,
yeah,
there you are. For the rest of the story, turn to the memoir.
All right. Apparently the memoir's X-rated.
Chapter 3.
All right. my dad is being typically coy when it comes to sex. I have a question now from Brendan, and let's go out on this one, Dad. And I'd like you to go as far as with this as you'd like. Any regrets?
Any regrets?
For real.
For real. Let me see. Let me see.
I mean, you have a wonderful life. You've made it over the finish line, so to speak. There has to be some regrets.
Regrets. Yep. Regrets that that I wasn't raised in a family or a society that is nearly as open in their affections, love, demonstrations as families are nowadays.
Yep.
I see it, and there's a great contrast there. There was always a reserve built in. For instance, I called my father Sir, and that when you hear that, that sums up that whole generation and many, many generations before that, yep. back to Victorian times. My mother, I did call Mummy, but there was that Sir. Again, if I were to say regret, that was the word he used. When I left Ireland, I mentioned this in the memoir, I took off like that. I mean, my parents, because I was away at private schools for between the age of 12, 13 until, you know, 5 years later, I was always regarded in the family, I was the only one who was away like that at boarding school, private schools, as being on his own,
yep.
a little bit. And therefore, when I said I was going to go to Canada, I just signed the documents and that was it. I didn't consult my parents at all because there was that kind of, with the reserve came a certain independence,
sure.
Strength of character. And so, to put it that way, maybe it was somebody else. And so I, in the memoir again, I mentioned that when I look back, I think to myself, was there some lack of love in that I didn't express that before I left? Of course I loved my parents. Of course I embraced them. But I didn't feel anything. Now, maybe that is youth, that you just go off and do those things.
And you didn't see your mother again after that?
Never saw her again. Because when I went away within 6 months, no, within, let me see.
1954?
Yeah, within 4 months, she was dead. Heart wow. attack. So that to me, I always regretted that. But again, and I've written about that, as I've said, regret is a difficult emotion. And in some ways, the most, how would I say, fruitless of emotions. It's what could have been. And in a sense, that had to be. I mean,
sure.
I think sometimes of a person, there's a spring inside them that must uncoil, and that uncoiling of the spring is their destiny unraveling out there, unraveling in the best sense, playing its way out. I had to leave, and therefore that was that, and don't regret it. And if that sounds callous, I do regret it because I would like to have said it more openly.
Sure.
Again, what do I regret in life? I regret that certain conversations and there would have been that I could have had with Mum Renata, that I could have had. Now I say, gosh, I wish she were here that we talk about that. Now that's the kind of regret that goes with objects that are lost.
Yeah, I hear that. I have the same regrets with her. It's hard. That's a nice question, Brendan.
Pardon me.
It's okay, Dad. We all miss her. I like my regrets too. They're like my tattoos and my scars. You know, they're permanent. But how I look at them doesn't have to be negative.
Yeah,
but
right,
they exist.
Right, right, exactly.
I've made drastic mistakes in my life. I've taken paths that I would never take again if I were flown back in time. But I kind of dig what's going on today. And I love your metaphor, Dad, of the spring. You know, when I was joking with my... I wasn't actually joking about the phrase when he said putting the stethoscope up to the human frame. One of my gifts with you, Dad, is being able to hear language like this. And when you talk about the uncoiling of a spring, I picture that. And I picture that idea of the realization of oneself through the determination that has to happen of their life. And regardless of your thoughts out there, because my dad and I differ slightly, he feels things are predetermined, I don't. But there is a potential that one has. And even Oprah talks about it. You know, our only job in life is to find out our life's purpose.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And so if we allow the spring to uncoil, we're effectively living our life's purpose.
Yep.
But nobody does that without bumping against a few things or not saying or saying what we should.
Oh, yeah. And anybody who doesn't face that, I think, is living a less rich life than they could have. It's back to the old cliche, but it's still a very rich one that we talk about, the road not taken.
Yeah.
That should I have gone that road? Should I have gone this road? And it's the, and there is where, again, I quote Blake often, but Blake says, you need both things, the opposites, the yin and the yang.
Yeah.
And if you've only got the yin, that you're not going any place.
Well, you know what? Anybody who's listening to this podcast this long won't mind. Oh, the chair just broke.
Oh, Jesus.
This is the chair from our kitchen since the 70s, and it still breaks. I'm going to read The Road Not Taken. It's not that long a poem, but I actually want to discuss it briefly after. The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost. We all know the phrase, The Road Not Taken, but I want to read the poem. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both, and be one traveler long I stood, and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then the other, just as fair, or then took the other, just as fair, and perhaps having the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that, the passing there had warned them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay, in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Mm-hmm. Now, what I love about that poem is that I believe it has been misquoted effectively in terms of context.
Oh, tell me.
Well, what he's basically saying is that both roads were the fucking same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. He's basically saying it didn't actually matter. And this whole idea that we need to take the road less traveled because that will steal us is, I believe, how the poem's been taken in modern culture. But in context, he's really saying one day he's going to say it made all the difference. But the reality is standing before them, you just kind of got to pick a route.
Yep, you have to, yep. And he did pick his route.
He did pick his route.
Yep, and despite what one could say about, you know, the riches of ambiguity, he really is a poem of someone looking back and saying there were two roads, and here's the one I chose, and I'm here now as an old man. That's
right.
What he's really saying.
I think that's kind of it.
And that's it. But I think that the key thing is to ask those questions, you know, because...
Sure.
So many of us, I've been telling everybody I've met, and I put that question to them, they say, yeah, you know, I can remember, I think I might have gone that way or should have gone that way.
Yeah.
Now, I think I prefer to say might have gone that way rather than should.
I agree.
Because
I think should is a dreadful
word. If you say should, then you'd say all those years in between or since
the
then.
The weight of the word should. People, if you're listening, just abandon should from your I should ... Either do it or don't.
Do it
I
or
should
don't.
Have. Nope. Yep. You did what you did, and you did it with the best information at the time.
And if
enjoy
you say,
it.
And if you're saying now, I should have done that, what I would say is don't say should. Change your life now, then.
Do it now.
Do it now.
Oh, well,
change
so
your life.
This is interesting. And to the people listening, you know, I haven't done this podcast in a couple of years, but I've bought a house in the time since. And actually, the breakup I went through was actually fundamental to the fact that I ultimately do want a family and kids in a way that I wasn't going to be able to have with Emily, who I think nothing but the best of, but it wasn't going to move forward the way I needed. The point being is that I always thought, oh man, if I could go back in time, I'd have bought real estate. Mm-hmm. Well, do it now then. And I always believe that when I have that should, what you just said is exactly right. That's your indicator that you now know what you should do now. Mm-hmm. Oh, I should have taken a guitar when I was younger. Great, go take it now. And as I always say, like I'm 44, I will be 50. Mm-hmm. I can be 50, a black belt at jiu-jitsu, or 50 and not have done jiu-jitsu because I'm 44. Why would I bother?
Yeah, right.
And as you've always said, your best years were 50 to 75.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
So if you're listening, and I always try and turn this a little positive because why not? Imagine this. Your best years are 50 to 75, according to my dad, or his were, and that means they can be for you. Whatever's going on with you right now, if you're 28, if you're 33 and you're struggling, or you feel like you're late to something, well, start it now. Don't should it. But at the same time, you're not late for anything.
Yep.
You're just living. I'm not wrong in my reading of this poem, right?
He's effectively saying that. Absolutely. By the way, I'm working on a song right now. The lyric, it was called It Never Is Too Late.
Okay.
Yep.
well, you're a living example of that.
It never is too late. Well, right at the moment, I'm 92. I think 92 I am.
Keep going, Dad. 91. We'll get you to 92.
91. And so I still have things to do.
Yeah, you do. Yeah,
why not? Why not?
Well, so the last thing I do want to say, and this is just my own joy from this poem, and it's sad. And I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. Mm-hmm. That hits me every time.
Yeah.
Because to me, that's one of the saddest things of life, is you do hit a fork in the road, and you do have to pick, and you're probably never going back there.
Yeah.
You're probably never going back to that relationship or that job or that thing because you won't be the same person.
Yeah.
The path will change you, and going back might not even be a good idea. But in that moment, each path would have been equally good.
Yeah.
And I often find it sad that you don't get to do both.
Well, you know, again, you're back to Greek philosophy. Heraclitus.
We're always back to Greek philosophy.
Heraclitus and Parmenides. Parmenides, who was saying everything is as is. And Heraclitus, you know, in that little phrase that comes up, you never put your feet in the same water again.
Yeah.
It's always flowing by.
Yeah.
And so between those two philosophers of Stasis and, you know, Kinesis, where do you get your pick? Back to Blake again? You need both.
Well, I wish there were two of me. I wish there were three of me. One would always be napping and having baths.
Yeah.
And then the two others would be quite active.
No, but what it means to in another way is putting it in a human frame that you can love a person romantically, sexually, all those things at, let's say, at 30 years of age, and then you may lose that person, but that doesn't mean to say you won't find another person at 40 years of age and love them equally, and you're more enriched by that loss that you had, which could have been painful. And I'm thinking of my own case, in which I was in love with someone very, very, you know, very, very deeply, lost that particular girl. You know, we broke up.
When
I moved on then again, I was the richer for it. And I look back and I think, what a wonderful time I had, although there was a deep sense of loss when it was over. But then we all suffer that, and we're not egotistic or special. We all are going to suffer those
kinds
of things.
Well, as our friend Neil says, you accept the sadness, but you don't wallow.
Exactly. That's a good phrase. Yep.
With the theater school I went to down the street at Queen and Broadview, there's a bridge.
Yeah.
And over the bridge, it says, the river I step in is not the river I stand in.
There you are.
And,
Heraclitus.
I saw that going to lunch every day at theater school. So there's a little Heraclitus for y'all.
Yeah,
and bear that in mind. Whatever you think you're entering won't be the way you think it was even upon entering.
And now I will say my last word. I'm dying to go out and sit in your new car while we drive around a little bit.
We go balling.
Yep, a lovely new Hyundai. What's the
Tucson, Dad.
Tucson.
Yep. Yeah. Well, coffee's on me. Let's go get one.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll chat with you next week.
Bye. Thanks.